One of the biggest questions I'm getting on this journey, when are you going to get Tim Wendelboe on? When can we talk to Tim Wendelboe? Can I ask Tim Wendelboe a question? Well, those answers are now. Episode 10. Yeah, we made it to 10. You guys liked, shared everything enough that I still got a place to talk. And here we are. Episode 10, the Brenton on Tour podcast with Tim Wendelboe, champion roaster, has got one of the best cafes in the world. It's a full AeroPress cafe. If you've heard me talk about AeroPress, there's so many cool things about what he's doing. And he's going to talk for a full hour this week. I'm not breaking it up. I'm giving you the whole thing. Thanks for liking, sharing, entering the Leverpresso contest. I'm going to announce it next week who the winner is. But you got to keep liking. You got to keep sharing. Let's get it out there this week. This is a big episode. A lot of people waiting to hear my conversation with Tim Wendelboe when I let the cat out of the bag that he was joining me. So big thanks to Tim for making the time. Hopefully you guys got one of those big giant mugs of coffee that I talked about in the first episode. And you're settling in because you're going to learn something. Tim Wendelboe, episode 10. Here we go.
Oh, no, thanks. I can't drink coffee late at night. It keeps me up.
First pot!
You're listening to the Brenton on Tour Coffee Cast, brought to you by things that make coffee, people who make coffee, people who love coffee, and maybe just coffee. You have no idea who he is, but he's on the search for the best coffee in the world. So pour a cup, grab a seat on the John, and maybe, just maybe, you'll stop drinking shitty coffee. It's the Brenton on Tour Coffee Cast with your host, that guy you don't know. Here's BD.
Welcome, friends, this week to the Brenton on Tour Coffee Podcast. I couldn't be more excited about my guest who has been an integral part, which he doesn't know yet, but integral part to my coffee journey from around the world. One of the most popular, I mean, I'd like to do your bio for you. I don't know. I'll just tell you this much. My favorite coffee from all of last year in one of my most favorite cafes in the world, if not my favorite in the world, that I stumbled upon by accident and has now guided me in my coffee journey and other people that I tell. I got the very awesome Tim Wendelboe from Oslo, Norway on the line. How you doing, sir? Thanks for joining me.
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you on here. I'm a huge fan of your coffee.
Thank you.
And a huge fan of what you're doing there. I travel with an AeroPress, have converted my wife from drip coffee over to AeroPress. And you've got one of the most amazing cafes I've ever been to.
Thank you.
Which is basically a full AeroPress cafe. And it's unbelievable. So I wanted to get you on here as I'm building this coffee podcast and sort of taking people on my journey. And I thought, well, I want to bring you on and see if I can get you on, because I think people need to learn about your coffee. So why don't you give our listeners a little brief bio on yourself, and then we'll get going on a few things.
All right. So I live in Oslo, Norway, where I've been living my entire life. And I started out as a barista after high school. I was 19 years old, so that's 21 years ago. And just by coincidence, actually. So I actually didn't like coffee when I started working with coffee, and didn't even know what a coffee shop was, because it was kind of a brand new thing in Norway. And because it was kind of the start of the coffee shop era in Oslo, there was a lot of people who were, trying to figure out how to make good coffee, and we were talking to each other and learning from each other. We created, or not we, but some people created what today is the World AeroPress, Barista Championship in Norway. So I kind of got into that quite early and got totally hooked on coffee, mainly because of the preparation in the beginning. But then once the coffee started to get or taste better, I also started liking it. And then I had to get into coffee as well. And today I have my own company, which is a small company in Oslo, Norway, where we roast and import coffee. And we also have a coffee shop where we serve espresso-based drinks and AeroPress, yes.
It's funny that you mentioned about the process, and that's what got you into coffee, because almost everyone I know that's addicted to coffee, or at least a part of the coffee culture, or would consider themselves part of the coffee culture, are as addicted to the process of making it as much as they are drinking it.
In North America, it's a very common drive-through. I don't know if you've been to, you know, America, North America, Canada, anything like that, like, you know, the US or any of those markets, but our whole scene is drive-through coffee, really, you know, pull up, you know, you grab a coffee and a donut and then you drive away. And Starbucks is here and there's a, you know, but I'm finding that as I'm rolling through this journey for the first time, I'm discovering that coffee culture has become a huge part of North America now. And I think it's relatively new. So how old is it in Oslo? Because you said you're only, you know, a handful of years in really into the coffee scene. How long has the actual coffee scene been in Oslo?
You know, no, it's been, I mean, culturally coffee came to Norway like in the 1700s. But after the Second World War, of course, Norway was one of the poorest countries in the world and or in Europe, not in the world, in Europe. And we got a lot of help from the US. And of course, the government kind of didn't want us to spend dollars on you know, coffee. But what the coffee roasters did was they were sending down codfish that we had a lot of to Brazil, and then we got coffee back. So just because of that, we started off with having quite high quality coffee in the supermarkets very early on after the Second World War. And that kind of boosted, I think, the coffee culture here in Norway, because you could access really good quality coffee very easily. And then once Starbucks kind of came to America and Norwegians started to travel to America, some people were studying in America, I think in the early 90s, and then they took the kind of coffee culture or the cafe or coffee bar experience. They wanted to start that in Oslo. So that started actually in the mid 90s. And when I started working in 98 in a coffee shop, that, you know, I think there was like four or five coffee shops in the entire country. And then in the 2000s, of course, many, many more opened. And today we have, you know, a coffee bar on every corner, but we don't have a lot of Starbucks here, and they actually just came to Norway, I think, 4 or 5 years ago. So it's a very kind of Nordic coffee culture that you don't see in so many other countries. It's very kind of national and not so international, if you know what I mean, when it comes to coffee shops.
But it seems so new, like you're saying 98, though. So like it's really, would you say that it's really this current trend of coffee culture, would you say then that this is, it's really only about 20 to 25 years old? Is that really,
for sure.
Really? Yeah. That's amazing. And then you guys started, you know, doing competitions and all the rest of it. So you're, you know, that's new to Oslo and new to Norway as well. Or did you join the rest of them around the world?
No. Actually the competition history is pretty interesting because, my old boss actually went to the US together with one of his colleagues and friends. And there was a barista competition in a coffee trade show called the Specialty Coffee Association. But it was all about kind of adding sugar-based syrups into cappuccinos and nothing more. So they decided to make something different here in Norway. And I think that was in 1998 as well, right before I started working in coffee. And so they kind of made it more kind of espresso and cappuccino focused. And then they had like a signature beverage at the end and so on. And that format that they created in Norway in 98 became the World Barista Championship in the year 2000. And the format is more or less the same today. So, before this competition and kind of in the mid 90s, the whole kind of what people refer to as specialty coffee was very, very new. And the phrase specialty coffee was coined by an American Norwegian lady who I don't remember the year, but she, you know, it was, I think in the 90s that this kind of thing appeared. And it all came out of, you know, Pete's Coffee and Starbucks, I think. The whole kind of wave that you're seeing today with coffee shops and roasters, it kind of started with those in Berkeley in California.
Do you drink only your coffee? or when you're traveling, When you're traveling around, are you on the search for amazing coffee like the rest of us? Or do you, you know, will you slip into a Starbucks or will you slip into, you know, a Lavazza or Illy place, which, you know, Illy and Lavazza were like, you know, early parts of my journey. So, you know, I always have a soft spot for them. But do you just kind of like, yeah, I'll just run in here and grab something from this cafe? Or are you?
Not really. You know, I never had that kind of, the need to drink coffee. So I didn't like coffee before I started kind of drinking good coffee. So if the alternative is bad coffee, I just won't have coffee. There's plenty of other beverages I can drink, you know, tea or beer or juice or whatever. But I always try when I travel to visit good coffee shops, and I kind of know where to go because the industry is not that big, and I can just ask friends who live in that country, you know, which are the top three that I should visit on my visit or whatever. So when I travel, I of course drink other people's coffees, but when I'm home, I mainly drink my own coffee, but I do taste a lot of coffees from other roasters and cafes, and also, you know, Starbucks coffee. We have to kind of, you need to kind of have some reference to where you are in the market. So you need to taste both good and bad coffee, I think.
Now, why AeroPress? Now, I discovered, this is funny. So this is my newness to the journey. So I was in Oslo for an event, and my AeroPress had broken. Like, just I was missing a couple of parts from it more than anything. And I had gone into one of the local malls, and they had said, no, we don't, but you should go out to this cafe. They may have some. And it was your cafe that they sent me to. Great. And by accident, I walk into the place, and it's a full AeroPress cafe. And I couldn't believe it, because my neighbor up the street from me opened a coffee cafe, and she did AeroPress, you know, which is a whole process that, you know, people need to adjust to. And it was some of the best coffee I've ever had. So when I walked in there, I was like, holy, it's a whole AeroPress cafe. So what made you decide AeroPress? Like, is there other methods that do you have other cafes where you run your product through, espresso machines or anything like that? Or is your storefront AeroPress all the way, and you're go AeroPress, you know? But how did come together? Because it's a hell of a product.
Well, I have to say that we also have an espresso machine, and we sell a lot of espresso drinks, but probably 50 to 60% of our coffees are made on the AeroPress. And the reason why we chose that was actually kind of coincidental as well. I don't think the brew method is that important. You can make really good coffee regardless of brew method, but you just need to know how to do it. And some brew methods are very slow, and I don't like to stand in line and wait for my coffee, and the AeroPress is very quick. So that was kind of why it was an option for us. But it actually started with, we bought this $10,000 by the cup coffee machine called the Clover, which was made in America. And it was great. And you can make coffee to order real quick in like a minute. And then, but the problem was the machine broke a lot, and then Starbucks bought the company who made the machines, and it started getting difficult to get spare parts and so on. So and then one of my employees came in with an AeroPress one day and said, hey, I think we should start to import these because it's great. And then I tried it, and I kind of, you know, found it a little strange, but it made good coffee. And so then we asked Robit if we could import AeroPress, and they said yes. And then we became the distributor. And of course, once it came, we didn't really know how to use it. So we created what we call the World AeroPress Championship, which is actually a thing.
It's unbelievable.
And then, we discovered, we could make a coffee as fast as on that $10,000 machine. But, you know, the AeroPress doesn't break. And if it breaks, it's quite cheap to replace instead of having that machine. So then we just decided, let's just make all our coffees on the AeroPress. And it'll also help on our sales, of course, when people see us using it, and they can learn how to make good coffee on their own at home. And So it was kind of a myriad of things that made us decide to only use that. And to be honest, we considered changing it in our store because the demand is high now. So we kind of need more capacity, but so far it's still the AeroPress that we prefer to brew with. And doesn't mean you can't brew good coffee on like a filter brewer or whatever. It's just, it's a little bit faster, I think, for us at least, in with our kind of setup, it's faster for us to use the AeroPress.
And for people that want to, you know, check out the setup, there's a couple things. So, you know, in the big picture of things, Tim, it doesn't necessarily matter. However, I did have a top five coffee from last year that I posted on my Instagram where I did a rundown of my top five, and you guys were number one. And I put a picture of the cafe up there. So if people want to see what the cafe looks like just from you know, my journey from last year, you can find it in my coffee section on the Instagram. But online, you've got, you know, instructional videos, how you guys make it, and you guys can really check out what the cafe looks like. It's a must visit. I just sent my friend Brent Fitz there in there when he was with Slash in town playing on the recent world tour that they did. And he walked in and was like, oh my God, this place is amazing. And it was really, I think people need to see it to really see what it's all about. Can you explain a little bit about that method? Because you touched on the subject in there where you said you don't like waiting for coffee and you found that it's quicker with the AeroPress. But in North America, some would still find the method of AeroPress too long. So, like, you know, having like some would go, oh, I have to wait for the coffee to boil. Or, you know, and I know you guys have you have a predetermined temperature, but can you break down that method to people? They walk into your place and what's the process that you put them through? Because it's amazing. Your water temperature is perfectly, perfectly set. Like how do you make it so quick?
You know, so when you come in, we have a little menu on the counter where you can choose between the coffees we have to offer. So normally it's about 6 to 8 coffees. And then if you choose your coffee, we'll have to, you know, grind the beans into the AeroPress. We normally preheat it a little bit with some hot water and just to rinse the paper filter. And then the coffee goes into the AeroPress. We weigh out 14 grams coffee that's in the AeroPress. And then we put it underneath a water boiler that has 93 degrees water going straight onto the coffee, so 200 grams of water. And then we stir it 3 times. We put a little kind of plunger on just to create a vacuum so the water doesn't go through the paper filter. And then after a minute, we take the plunger off, we stir 3 times, wait a couple of seconds, and then we press. And in total, the whole process takes 2 minutes maximum, unless there's a huge line, of course, with the AeroPresses, then it might take a little bit longer. But you have to realize that Oslo is full of places where you can buy coffee and get it very quickly. And people don't come to our cafe to get a quick coffee. They come to have a good cup of coffee. So
absolutely,
most of our guests are, you know, willing to wait 1 or 2 minutes for a nice cup of coffee. And of course, sometimes we have a line, especially in the summer. So they have to wait a little bit longer, unfortunately. But we're trying to have enough baristas behind the counter to kind of run through the lines pretty quickly. And on busy days, we actually have one person standing all day, only making AeroPress, not doing nothing else. So we kind of have a designated AeroPress person.
Do you, and you were mentioning 93 degrees, is that the optimal coffee temperature? Or have you messed around with the temperature of the water over you know, the time?
No, that's a good question, actually, because there's a lot of opinions there. And for me, with our coffees, because we roast pretty light, we can use, you know, boiling water. You're going to lose some temperature regardless when you pour it onto the coffee, because the coffee is, you know, room temperature. The brewing device is also normally room temperature or a little bit hotter and so on. Fortunately, with the AeroPress, it's made of plastic, so it doesn't steal a lot of heat from the water. So that means we can actually run slightly lower water temperature out of the boiler. And the reason why we do 93 is because if we do higher, we actually have to wait for the boiler to kind of get up to temperature. Whereas with 93, we don't have that kind of lagging time. And then you just adjust your grind setting to kind of fit that temperature. But a lot of people say that you need lower water temperature. And even if you read on the recipe on the AeroPress box, it says it's best with 80 degrees water, and that's Celsius.
Which,
Which I, in Fahrenheit, I don't know. You have to figure it out.
Yeah, I've had many methods of doing it. And people, if they want to learn, and I encourage you all to go to Tim's website. It's Tim, just basically timwendelboe.com, correct? I believe.
Yeah, or .no or .com, doesn't matter.
And so there's loads and loads and loads of videos on there on how this method works. And you've got, you know, inverted, you've got all these different cool videos for people that, you know, want to test out coffee. And it's a must watch if A, you have an AeroPress. I'm guessing that anyone listening to this is going to do me a favor and run out and buy one. The message as soon as you're done, because it's literally one of the best methods I've ever had. But there's some videos on there that are super educational, and I think that's a really great thing that you are doing as far as educating people on the method. And do you have you personally? I mean, obviously, you probably have an AeroPress at home, yeah? Or what kind of gear?
Yeah, of course.
What kind of gear are you working on at home? Do you have anything more than that, or is it one of those things where it's like that's good enough for you?
No, actually, normally I make coffee for both my wife and myself, so we actually use just an automatic filter brewer that I helped develop here in Norway, and then we have a small home grinder, and that's normally what I would use because we have to make 2-3 cups at a time. But when I'm traveling, and also if I'm kind of going on a cabin trip or whatever, I normally would bring an AeroPress just because it doesn't weigh anything and it's easy to use. And the problem is that when you start pulling out your AeroPress and your hand grinder and you start making a good cup of coffee, everyone around you wants one as well. So you just end up standing all day making coffee for everyone.
listen, I run concerts for a living, Tim. All right. So I travel, I travel the world with bands and I run concerts, and I always have a coffee station set up, and wherever I can, I actually try to have your product. I have other, you know, beans from around the world wherever I go, but I always try to have a bag of Tim Wendelboe standing by, just because people drink what they drink. And then I'm like, okay, come, you know, when you want the good stuff, come and hang out. But the second I break out the AeroPress, I was making coffees for people in catering because the kettle was there and I would just go in, make myself a coffee or whatever. And then people would just stop what they were doing and come and line up and taste it. And I was like, oh, this is like the next 25 minutes of my life to half an hour if I'm, you know, not careful, because people will just line up. And so then I moved the whole process to my office.
Yeah.
More for a personal coffee, but you know, for people in the know to stop by. And it's still a lineup outside if I'm not careful once they start brewing it. So I feel your pain, man. So it's
the downside, especially if you're doing hand grinding. But you know, I always had pleasure of kind of serving other people nice coffee, and yeah, it's a nice thing, but it can also be quite annoying if you're just, you know, in a hurry in the morning and
you're
in a hotel and everyone wants to have a cup of coffee, you know?
Yeah, neighbor's knocking in. So Tim, I wanted to ask about, you know, how long your journey was to establish yourself here. You know, how long did it take you to get that cafe up and running, and what would you be deemed successful, as well as, you know, your roastery and being able to, because you ship your beans all over the world as well. So how long was that process to really establish yourself as what I consider to be the top guy? But
it's hard to say. I mean, I have been working with coffee for 21 years and been kind of loud spoken in for all those years. But I used to run a coffee bar chain in the mid 2000s. Early 2000s with a friend of mine, and that's also when I was competing in the world championship, which was pretty new back then, and I managed to win that championship in 2004. And after that, I kind of started getting invited to travel and do lectures, and I've always kind of been into trying to share knowledge with people, because that's the best way to learn. I think when you kind of share your knowledge, people will start sharing theirs, and you kind of have a good information exchange. So Well, after 2004, I was kind of running a coffee bar chain with a friend. And when I won the world championship, I was just traveling more and more, and I decided to leave the company. I think 1st of January 2006, I was kind of freelancing. And freelancing is nice, but there's long periods where you don't have work at all in coffee. I was mainly doing kind of consulting for other barista competitors and so on. So, and I also decided I needed a kind of a home base where I could do trainings and teach people. And fortunately, my old employer decided to invest in my company and lend me the money to start a company. And in 2007, I opened up my cafe and roastery and kind of built it from there. And it's been a long process, of course, but our goal has always to kind of be only dealing with the best possible coffees and trying to be, you know, considered one of the best roasteries in the world. That's kind of our hairy goal. That's, you know, it's not measurable, but we don't want to deal with kind of mediocre coffees, or we're always trying to push ourselves to be better. And that's been an ongoing process. And, you know, we've been competing in roasting competitions, and I always try to share whatever I learn so that other people can also make good coffee. Because it's hard to be alone in the market. You need other people also to be doing the same things that you are, so that we can get more people interested in coffee and so on. So it's still a process that's ongoing, I think. And I'm working hard every day. This kind of typical story where every day for me is a work day, and it's more than 10 hours a day. For me, it doesn't feel like work. It's fun, you know? So.
I noticed, yeah. I have a friend of mine, I'm from Canada and I'm in Vancouver. I have a friend of mine opening a brewery there, and craft brew,
yeah,
and craft beer and everything. And it's been a really cool process watching what he's been going through. And I noticed that he has been getting a lot of support from the craft beer companies. You know, it's not as competitive as one would think. I mean, it's competitive from the people picking a spot to drink. And I'm sure it's the same in coffee, where people have to decide where they're, you know, getting their coffee from. And it's a constant battle to get your product out there. But yeah, there's not, sure. There seems to be a real support system in place, though, for roasters and people that are in this journey and trying to put out the best product, like, as you said, you know, on a daily basis. Yeah. I am currently in Jacksonville. I was hanging out yesterday, the last couple of days, with a couple of different breweries here and roasters and just people that are doing, you know, coffee and beer, coffee and wine and little cafes and things like that. And one of the places that I stumbled upon was a place called The Flamingo. Mm. And that team has got this really cool little cafe going where they're doing, you know, especially beer and wine and coffee. And the coffee was really, really great. And Paul from there mentioned to me, when they were up and running, that they reached out to you and you reached back out to them to give them some advice on opening up. So it was impressive to me that, you know, even at the level, and, you know, everyone's got a top level, and I would deem yours being the top coffee in the world. So to make the time for these guys opening up is a real, real tip in your hat, and also to even come on a podcast like this that's just starting. So I did reach out to Paul, and when I told him that you were coming on, and he said he had a question for you. Great. That he wanted to ask. And I've also was able to talk to one of our guests from a couple of weeks ago named Jeremy Gersey, and he is a roaster out of LA and Las Vegas that does a lot of specialty blends for actors, bands, plus he's all over Hollywood with his stuff, and he sent over a handful of questions. So if you don't mind,
no.
I'm going to take a couple of questions, quote unquote, from our audience, and we'll do a little Q&A.
Let's do it.
So stand by. So first on the line will be Paul from Flamingo with a question for you. So here you go, sir.
Yo, 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 my brothers. This is Paul Johnson Carr from Jacksonville, Florida. I'm one of the proud owners of the Flamingo Coffee Bar. We're located in the beautiful Sunshine State, the city of Jacksonville, in the Murray Hill area. Brother Brent, first off, I appreciate you so much for putting this on. I'm honored to know you and to have met you, and I'm stoked to have this opportunity to ask Brother Tim a question. Brother Tim, first off, Man, I respect you so much. I'm honored to throw a question at you. I just want to first off tell you how much I appreciate you and everything you do. From someone that works in coffee as a barista to now a cafe owner, to be able to receive the information that you put out and to apply it into my cafe and our coffee scene. It's incredible. I appreciate you so much. So my question is, where do you see coffee in the next 5 years? Where do you see the cafe in the next 5 years? I'm curious, what's your 5-year plan? What's your 10-year plan? What are you thinking down the road when it comes to the future of coffee?
Wow, that's a question I get a lot, and that's always difficult to answer. But I think we will see a lot of consolidation and a lot of roasting companies also maybe closing, like just like with microbreweries. They had like a huge kind of boom many years ago, and we're seeing that in coffee today. And I think it's getting quite competitive. And so a couple of things that happens in the market at the moment is that a lot of roasters are looking to get cheaper coffees because they think they can compete on price. And that's, you know, it's not great for the coffee farmers. And then you also see other roasters doing really well, while some roasters are not doing so well. So I think we're going to see some consolidation in the market. And hopefully we're also going to see better coffees coming into the market, because on the farmer side, we do see more and more farms getting professionalized and accessing great varieties and, you know, experimenting with processes. So I think we're going to see a lot more exciting coffees also in the markets, despite that, you know, some roasters might disappear and some might consolidate and so on. Technology wise, I don't really know. I'm hoping that we'll get even better roasting machines that will help us, you know, roast coffee even better. I think feel like that's the kind of the biggest challenge today, is not to brew coffee better, but to actually roast coffee better. And also maybe coffee grinders should get better. But, you know, I don't think any technology will make the coffee much better than it is today, because in the end, it's just water and coffee mixed together somehow. So from the farming side, that's the kind of where I'm most excited. We will see better coffees coming into the market and new varieties and so on.
Thanks, Paul, for your question. Thanks for that, Tim. Do you, as you roll through the process of finding your beans, you're discovering the world of the business. And yeah. What's your take on what's happening with, there's a lot of controversies in the coffee business right now with the way people are being worked, or you know, where people are getting their beans from, and sometimes there's women and children involved that are working long hours all days and for little pay. What is your take on that? I mean, how are you trying to combat that with the way that your method, you know, your method of finding your beans and being conscious of trying to find the best farmers that are doing the best for the city environments? Like, what's your take on that side of the business right now?
Well, this is something that I probably speak about this every day, actually, because there's a lot of, I would say, misinformation in our industry, and a lot of people claiming things that might not be exactly true. But because I'm staying on a farm for at least 3 months a year in Colombia, because I own my own farm, I bought a piece of land from a farmer that I buy coffee from, and I spent 3 months a year there farming or working on my farm myself. So I stay in his house, and I get to talk to Elias a lot. He is telling me stories, and, you know, I can see what people are doing in the Colombian market, at least the buyers, some of them claiming that they're, you know, paying very good prices. But when it all comes down to it, it's, you know, not sustainable for the farmers to sell the coffees for those prices, even though they're higher than the market price. So one of the issues in coffee is that most people are looking to the international coffee exchange, or the ICE price, or the market price for a commodity coffee, which is today around $1 per pound of green coffee. And The production cost is more often than not higher than $1 per pound for a farmer. So that means the farmers are losing money when they produce coffee. So before we even can start talking about, you know, paying the workers better and so on, we have to start paying more for the coffee. And the problem is that in specialty coffee, people still compare themselves to the market price of commodity coffee. But to produce good coffee, you need to take more care. You need to pay the pickers more to pick only ripe coffee cherries. You need to be more kind of hands-on with the process and drying and storage and milling. So it costs a lot more to produce that coffee than the normal commodity coffee that you'll typically find in the supermarkets. So if, for instance, a roaster say, you know, I'm a specialty roaster and I pay 20% above market price. And if they're referring to the C market, then that means they're still not paying for production costs. So fortunately, there's someone doing something about that today. And there's a group of roasters who, including myself, who have signed something called the Pledge, where we kind of are obliged to publish the prices that we're paying for our coffees and how much we're buying and so on. And based on this kind of numbers, we can start to establish what is actually a market price for good coffees. And then maybe that's, you know, $3 or $3.50. And then if you're paying lower than that, you're actually paying below market price and not above market price, which would normally be the thing.
So when they're paying below market prices, that puts the onus on the farmer to, you know, pay less to the workers, correct?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the one thing is for sure in coffee, and that is the farmer is the only person in this kind of chain that is not making money at the moment. And of course, there are many exceptions, and we are paying good prices, and there are also many other roasters paying good prices for the coffee. And the reason why I'm doing it is not out of charity. It's because they are my suppliers, and I see them as kind of an extension of my team here in Norway. So if I'm not paying them well, they're not going to produce, you know, coffee for me. And I've also been working with more or less the same farmers since 2009. And, you know, it's a long-term project that we have together in order to improve the quality of the coffee on their farm. And we're working together. It's not like I'm going down there and dictating them what to do. I'm visiting them. We're discussing new ideas and also new kind of investment projects for the farms in order for them to improve the quality of the coffee. And as long as they're kind of determined to do that, I'm determined to buy the coffee for a good price, and they know that. So we don't have a contract written or anything. We're more or less friends, and it's a gentleman's agreement. They know that I'm going to buy X amount of bags of coffee every year, and when they know that, they can also invest in the farm and also in the processes that I am requiring them to do in order to be able to sell the coffee to me. So
that's in Colombia. How long of that process was it to find the right spot? I mean, how many places did you have to look at to find the right bean? Because I'd imagine that, you know, Colombia is a huge country with a huge coffee business, and then you found your acreage and your spot. So
it's not the best land in the world, that's for sure, but for me it's not only about finding the best coffee, it's about actually finding the best potential and also the right people. And when you own your own farm, which I don't really recommend people buying a farm if they don't want to live on the farm, but when you're buying a farm in Colombia and you're not going to live on it, you need a person you can trust to help you and take care of the land when you're not there and so on. And Elias is one of those people. I mean, I see him more than I see my mom and dad all together, and because I stay with him for 3 months a year, and they're basically become family. And we talk about everything, even if I can immediately tell if he's upset about something, I can tell, you know, and then we try to talk about it. And, Colombia, you know, is a huge country. They have 500,000 coffee producers, more or less, and they all more or less grow the same varieties, but in different climatic conditions. And the problem there is that very often when I went there, I would taste good coffee, but it would never come from the same person. And that's just because they don't have enough money to kind of invest in paying the pickers a good price to only pick ripe cherries. They, you know, they don't know that if they invest that money in, into the coffee, they don't know if it, if they're going to get that money back when they sell it. So that's why I'm kind of working with one producer there and have been working with him for many years now. And every year we try to improve something on the coffee and we do experiments, and but we have a protocol that he needs to follow, and we agree about X amount of bags that he's going to do that protocol. And that, you know, when, because he produces more coffee than I can buy, and he's not able to sell all his coffee for a good price. So he would lose money if he did all his coffee with, after that process, if you know what I mean.
Well, it's the best coffee I've ever had. So I don't know what he's doing down there, but it's awesome. So it's really great.
I mean, I know personally, I have had a lot better coffees in Colombia, and especially from Nariño and Cauca. But the reason why I kind of ended up in Huila with Elias is, first of all, the person, and also that he had a farm that was 60 hectares. So if I did a lot of work there, I could actually get some volumes to buy. But also at the time where I was kind of looking for farms down there, Nariño and Cauca was a little bit more unstable with the FARC and everything. But I mean, I feel completely safe when I'm traveling in Colombia. I was just advised not to kind of stay 3 months in Nariño in a random farm in the mountains there, you know. So,
Speaking of great coffee roasters, so I had the pleasure of meeting Jeremy Garcia out of Vegas in LA. He was on my show a couple of weeks ago. He does coffee for bands. He does coffee for movie sets, and has got a really unique method of roasting, which you guys could probably chinwag over for hours, which is an interesting method of roasting, which is called the cloud roast, which never actually touches, you know, the roaster. It actually floats in the air. So it's a really cool process. And Jeremy's a big supporter of you. He's got a really great coffee that I love just as much as yours. From he's put a lot of passion. He's got an amazing story so far that he's built up, and he wanted to send in a couple of questions for you, if you don't mind taking a couple of those.
I figure
on this, we'll let him do his thing. So this is question number one from my friend Jeremy Garcia in Jeremy Garcia Coffee.
Hey Tim, Jeremy here from J. Garcia Coffee Roasters. Just want to say I'm a huge fan and have a lot of respect and admiration for you. My question to you is, what is your take on espresso extractions? Do you think there should be frecking, or do you think espresso should come out a solid, even color?
Wow.
Yeah, we brought the big guys out for this episode, let me tell you.
Never had that question before, actually, but it's quite interesting. I don't think, I'm not so hung up on color on espresso, to be honest. I think it should be like when you're making a filter brew, it's, the color in the beginning is always going to be darker because there's more to extract. And as long as the water is continuing pouring through the puck, you will just see lighter and lighter color on that water coming through. And I think why espresso is difficult is because you brew under pressure. It's very fine grinds. It's very easy to not do a proper kind of preparation of the cake of the coffee. So more often than not, you have very uneven extraction. It's very rare that I taste over-extracted espresso. It's very, very common that I taste under-extracted sour espressos. So for me, it's kind of a system that you have to figure out. And the best way to make a better espresso is to start measuring extraction and figuring out how you can extract the most out of your coffee, because most of the equipment doesn't allow you to extract enough of the coffee. And even if you buy the most expensive machine and the most expensive grinders, I still experience problems with burrs and problems with pressure and water flow. And the espresso just ends up tasting very, very sour. And every time I get a complaint from a customer that our coffee is tasting sour from their espresso machine, I know it's not our coffee, because it doesn't taste sour on our coffee machine. So then we have to go through and adjusting the machines and so on. So I think, to answer the question very simply, the color, it's normally darker in the beginning and lighter at the end. But you shouldn't see a lot of kind of light color coming through at the beginning, at least, because that means you didn't prepare your coffee puck well enough and the water is just flowing through some kind of easy way through the filter. And so whatever you can do to make the extraction as even as possible and as high as possible will make your espresso taste better. And if it's not tasting good, then maybe it's the roast and the coffee or the water that's the problem.
I find that most of the people I'm speaking to about espressos, the struggle is real on the burr and the grind and trying to figure out that. And it takes them sometimes 20 to 30 different espressos before they figure it out. And that's just for the home people at home. I'm sure it's a bigger struggle for people actually running a business and trying to get it right. So I can respect that journey a lot because I know when I get a bad espresso, I go, ah.
Yeah, I actually encourage people not to do espresso at home because it does take a lot of time to dial in every day. And it's just a lot of waste of coffee and a lot of waste of time for a very, very little amount of coffee. And making an AeroPress or a V60 or filter coffee is so easy and you get a bigger cup that you can enjoy for a longer time. So at least in only people that I know that doesn't want to have filter coffee is Italians. They still want their espresso, you know?
I'm traveling with I got a company out of South Korea made a product called a Leverpresso, and it's a little mini espresso maker. And I travel with it on tour to make little Americanos with me. And it's kind of a fun little product. You know, you get a little puck and next time in Oslo, I'll bring one by and show it to you. So.
Yeah. And we should make some in my store and have some espresso. I mean, I really, don't get me wrong. I really like espresso. It's just for a lot of people who are not that into espresso, it's a lot of money and a waste to get an espresso machine and so on. But I do have clients that they have La Marzocco Minis at home, like a machine that's, you know, it's not cheap. And then they've invested in a grinder and they love it, of course, but then it's sort of more of a hobby than it is just to making yourself a cup of coffee in the morning.
I've got one more question from Jeremy here. I believe it's on roasting, and we'll roll that, and then I'll finish up with you here because I know you got a busy day, or at least you're getting ready for dinner. Oh,
perfect. Yeah.
Hey Tim, Jeremy here from J. Gersey Coffee Roasters. My question to you is, do you have an ideal roast profile that you like to use? Obviously, I know from region to region it might vary profile-wise, but I'm wondering if you have a go-to profile you like to use.
Also a challenging question. A roast profile that I like to use. Well, it really depends on the roaster that I'm using, of course. And the first thing that I do when we get a new coffee is to measure moisture content of the coffee beans, because I know that a coffee bean with slightly higher moisture content, like 11% or more, needs more time and more energy in the roast. So on those coffees that have high moisture content, I would go quite aggressively in the beginning with heat and then quite gentle at the end of the roast, because there's a lot of water in the bean and it seems that you can kind of develop the bean with less energy at the end when it's very moist. If I have very dry coffees, which I do get from like Kenya and Ethiopia, where they have like 9% moisture, then we just roast, you know, quite fast, I would say, and more heat at the end and not so much heat at the beginning. But it really depends. And a lot of the coffees that I buy are quite different than what you would expect. So they're dried normally under shade and they're quite hard and dense. So normally my coffees can take a lot of heat and energy. So we just go with a standard profile where we start with quite aggressive heat and try to roast the coffees quite fast, around 10 minutes in our Loring roaster. But it really depends on the roasting machine and your setup, how you should do it. So it's always a matter of testing, and then if you're not happy, you try to speed up or slow down a little bit, but keep it simple. Don't do too many adjustments because that's just going to confuse you. That's my biggest advice, I guess.
Do you ever get to Las Vegas?
I've never been. No, never.
Well, now that Jeremy's your best friend now, you're going to have to go and check out his roastery. It's pretty great.
For sure.
it's pretty cool. Okay, my friend. Well, this has been a blast for me, I'll tell you. Let's finish up with a couple things and I'll let you get on your way.
where do you ship to? Because I found your beans in Cleveland the other day at Pour.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, great.
I walked in there. I researched generally where it's from, but that one, for whatever reason, didn't come up. And I walked in and I'm like, you've got Tim Wendelboe. They're like, yeah. So it was, and I had like three guys on tour with me that all just basically sunk into their chair after that. It was great. They loved it. So
great. I've been a customer for a while, actually.
Yeah. I just think I might not have caught it, but they definitely had a Tim Wendelboe display there, which was awesome. So where do you ship? Right. Where can people find your coffee?
Oh, we ship all over the world, but a lot of times it's coffee shops that, you know, have a rotational program. So they'll buy maybe once every 2 months or once a month or something like that. But Pour Cleveland has been a steady customer of ours. To be honest, I don't remember all of our clients because I don't really deal with sales anymore. But I know also there's a place called Bakers and Baristas in LA who buy our coffee. And also, of course, we have our website where we ship worldwide from our online store. And we have like a coffee subscription as well. That's kind of a little bit cheaper. So I choose our best coffees every month and send it out to our subscribers. And then we also make videos of those coffees where I taste those coffees with a friend, so you can get to learn a little bit about the coffees and so on. So
it's,
I think that's if you really
educational
coffee and want to have one or two or three bags per month, that's a good way to start.
The educational tool you have on your website is amazing. Some of the great videos that you have there, the various methods of how to make AeroPress and just your methods of roasting and all the rest of it. Any particular videos you would direct someone to on your site that you think is a good start for them to be introduced to Tim Wendelboe or just the world of coffee?
I think, you know, you could start with maybe how to make better coffee at home. I think we have like a general video of what kind of equipment you need in order to make good coffee at home, and, you know, talk a little bit about grinders and so on. I think that's the way to start. And then, you know, it's really simple to make good coffee. You just need to have good coffee. That's all you need, and good water. And then the brew methods, you can learn pretty easily online as well. So the point is, it's quite fun to make good coffee, and it's quite easy as well. So just get started.
If you're using your coffee every all the time, I'll tell you, my friend, it's definitely the best coffee I've come across in my short journey. So
thank you.
I look forward to getting back to Oslo, coming into the cafe and parking myself there for a couple hours and doing some work and just drinking your coffee all day. So one more time on the socials, let everybody know where they can find you. Is the pledge something online that people can be a part of to research what people are paying for coffee? Just anything like that. Direct people to where they got to go. And
I think the pledge, I don't remember the address online, but if you just Google pledge coffee, then you will see all the roasters who have signed it and who have kind of obliged to publish their prices. And there's quite a lot in the US actually, and all over the world as well. So that's a great initiative. And I would encourage, you know, people to support the roasters who are actually signing the pledge, because it really means a lot to the farmers and the future of coffee, I think.
Your favorite coffee shop in Oslo other than yours?
I would say Supreme Roastworks. They're 5 minutes away from my store, and they're really nice people and have really good coffees as well. And yeah, it's a really nice place to go.
And one final question for you, sir. The very first coffee article that I wrote on a site in Toronto called deanblundell.com was about coffee assholes and people that come into your cafe either. And it can be a coffee asshole. That's like a coffee snob, or, you know, it could be somebody that comes in and it's a particular kind of client that comes in and orders. But my question to you is, which coffee asshole are you? So for me, 'cause we all are in some capacity, I will only drink the good stuff now. So, you know, I'll be traveling around and my mom will want to go through it, or my, you know, friends or somebody will want to go through a drive through. And I'm like, nope, we're going here and we're going to wait in line. And like, you're an asshole. We just want to get good coffee. So, all right. How would you define yourself if you had to pick a version of a coffee asshole? Which one would you be?
I think my reputation, at least, have been that if you ask for my opinion, I will actually tell you my opinion, which a lot of times can put people off. So if they make me a cup of coffee and they ask me, how was it? And normally I perceive that as they want my honest opinion. So I would, you know, if it's not good, I would say, you know, I didn't like it, or I found it too roasty or whatever. And then where they might expect me to just say, oh, it was really nice. And then, but I've learned to kind of moderate myself a little bit when it comes to that. But that's kind of the asshole reputation that I've gotten, at least in the industry.
Well, it's not being called an asshole when you're the pro and you're the best at it, my friend. It's just an opinion. So anyways, thanks for the time, Tim. I really appreciate you coming on this podcast with me and helping me launch it around the world, because that's my plan. And I want to educate people on my journey of coffee and the fact that your cafe and your coffee has played a significant role in the beginning of my journey. It means a lot to me that you would spend some time with me to talk about your journey. So I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much.
Be sure to visit timbundable.com, head to his cafe and place in Oslo whenever you get a chance. And we will see you when I'm in Oslo, my friend.
Fantastic. Let me know and then we'll have a cup of coffee.
We'll have many cups. Thanks, buddy.
Fantastic.
Have a great day.
Thanks very much.
Looking to make the most out of this life and optimize your personal wellness? Then check out the Natural Man Podcast. Join me, host Mike C, as we explore all areas of human wellness, physical, mental, and emotional. Learn strategies to optimize your own well-being and be in the driver's seat of your own health. Remember, your doctor works for you. Learn biohacks, neurohacks, ways to improve sleep, and ways to optimize your body and your mind. Check us out on Apple, Spotify, The Fountain App, and at naturalmanpodcast.com.
It is your favorite girl. That's right, it's the Allie Mars, the one and the only. Everyone else just ain't me. I am the host of Welcome to Mars, a lifestyle podcast where nothing is off the table. I have come a long way from sex and dating, and have transformed the new vibe to all things lifestyle. We still talk sex, but I'm more interested in the journey, where people have come from, how they made it, and where they're going. Subscribe or follow to a brand new look and a brand new era. Welcome to Mars.
Subscribe or follow on Apple, Spotify, Google, or at theallymars.com.
Because even with the new look, I'm still that same bitch you love to hate.